Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Petapixel Podcast. Catch new episodes every week on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Petapixel Podcast, where we're going to talk about the latest photo and video news. And I get to do this every week with my two pals. Look, it's Chris Nichols on YouTube.
Hello.
He's got kind of a greenish background. Yeah. And look, who's that there as well? Is that Jaron Schneider broadcasting from Portland?
It is. And what color is my background?
It's like a purpley blue, but there's lots of different RGB lights
lavender
to draw the eye. So, and motion and everything. It's very distracting. It's like the end of 2001 over there. So, guys, I'm going to give you a little peek behind the curtain. I am absolutely frazzled. It's a huge week for a whole bunch of product coming out. I'm scrambling to put that together. At the same time, we're traveling. So when you hear this, we will be in Japan.
Yes.
So,
big Lumix event.
That's a lot going on in the next little bit. Just in case it feels a little unconventional and there might be some major news stories that we don't specifically address here, but there are some we know are coming that we really want to talk about. Big week for Fujifilm and Sigma. So we've got some news on that coming up. But before we get to that, I always like to start the show with a question. Right, guys?
Yeah, uh-huh. Our favorite.
All right. So you get to Japan. We've all been there before. They're like, okay, we don't have any dinner plans for this evening. What are you going
What's your favorite Love Hotel room? Is that what you're asking?
Favorite like, Love Hotel.
Like Subway Train or...
That's 209. Oh,
Surface
you mean,
the
oh,
moon.
The theme. Okay, I thought you meant the actual room number.
Oh, no. Oh, sorry, I cut you. You must have a different idea. Yours is probably way more interesting. What was your idea?
Oh, I was just going to say... where are you going to go for your, like, that you don't have any plans yet. You just arrived in Japan. What's your first meal you're going to eat there?
We know what Jaron's going to do. He's going to go right to a supermarket and get natto.
You can
no,
get that
if
home.
I was going to,
and it's just as gross at home.
It's equally disgusting, which is my favorite. Delicious. I mean, the konbini is a very tempting offer to go get an egg sandwich because it is delicious. But I don't know. I when I was last there with Richard, we had curry and tonkatsu, and that was really, really good. And this curry place that I picked was excellent. So I probably would do that, even though fish is... My mouth is watering. I'm hungry, obviously. The fish is always a good choice. I think I would do Japanese-style curry.
That is funny. That's exactly because I'm going to be in this situation. I'm arriving in Japan before Chris. I'm going to have like a solo meal. I'm like, you know what? I'm doing it. I'm going for my curry. Katsu curry, probably.
So that's a tough one. I do love katsu curry. Of course, we can get that anywhere. We can make it at home. I
can't make it at home. Yeah, it's
probably
better there.
I want to go. There's a restaurant in Osaka, I think, maybe in Tokyo too, but like apparently all they do is grill the fatty parts of different animals. And that sounds
okay, that
great.
Sounds so good.
Yes. Mm. So if this place exists, that's what I would ideally like to find is the place where they just cook fatty parts of animals and grill it, and I would eat the hell out of that. So that's what I want. But I also love, ramen, of course. Katsu curry is always good. All the food there is so good.
It's hard to go wrong.
I eat a lot when I'm there, but I always wind up losing weight because everything is healthier over there. So maybe if we go to the fatty fat restaurant, then I can actually skew that for the first time ever.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm starving now. At any rate, there is so much to talk about. Tons of stuff from Fujifilm, stuff from Sigma. Nikon's the amount that Nikon paid for Red, we broke that as of recording. We broke that yesterday.
Hot scoop.
Yeah, and it's now all over the place. But let's talk about everything next. If you're passionate about photography and considering an upgrade, or if you've been eyeing the OM1 Mark II, don't miss this fantastic offer from OM System. It's the perfect time to exchange your old equipment for the cutting-edge technology and outstanding image quality of OM System. During OM System's trade-in trade-up event throughout May and June, you'll enjoy significant savings. Here's what you need to know. Take your qualified interchangeable lens camera to a participating dealer for an evaluation. You'll receive the value of your trade-in plus additional rebates and offers on select products, increasing your savings even more. Plus, you'll receive a trade-up bonus towards the purchase of select OM System products, making this the ideal opportunity to upgrade. Here's the deal on savings. Save $600 on the OM1 Mark II body combined with the M Zuiko 100-400mm f5-6.3 IS lens, which is a perfect telephoto for wildlife or birding photography. This bundle is now just $27.99, a significant drop from its regular price, thanks to this limited time promotion. Additionally, take advantage of reduced prices on other lens bundles. Get $200 off the M Zuiko 90mm f3.5 macro IS Pro, ideal for macro enthusiasts, or enjoy the same number, $200 discount on the M Zuiko 40-150 f2.8 Pro lens, excellent for wildlife photography. Or take $300 off the M Zuiko 8-25 f4 Pro lens, perfect for capturing landscapes. Make the most of this opportunity to upgrade your gear with new high-performance, portable, and weather-sealed OM System equipment. These offers are only valid until the end of June, so act fast. Visit your nearest authorized OM System dealer or retailer, or check out explore.omsystem.com/petapixel for more information on how to upgrade your gear today. Thanks to OM System for sponsoring this episode of the Petapixel Podcast. All right, guys. So we knew that Nikon bought Red, and I think a couple of weeks ago I said we can be done talking about this for a while now. I lied. There's stuff to discuss, and it's that the amount that Nikon paid for Red has been revealed, and it's $85 million. Like, not even actually, just shy of that.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like a lot. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, $85 million, and that's for 100% stake in the company. So it's not a split anything. So
full absorption.
You know, Jim Jenner's happy, I'm sure. And Nikon's completely taken over. It does seem low.
It seems really low to me. Especially what was really interesting, just to have for those patents that now Nikon can
what was really interesting, though, is like, you know, of course, Red sued Nikon, and Nikon basically straight up said, in that whole lawsuit business, we found out so much about Red and their holdings and their company structure and you know what they're about. And it was just interesting how they actually used a lot of the information to then flip it around and be like, well, hell, we'll just buy you then. How's that sound? And I guess
I'm wondering if they were Red looking at how much it was gonna cost to pay them for the royalty that they were looking for, and then like how much, like, it wasn't put into the actual lawsuit how much money Red wanted to get from them, like as a damages in addition to the forcing them to license. So my guess is Nikon was looking at how much they were saying, and it was essentially like, okay, but why would we pay that when we could just buy you? But the other thing that's worth thinking about, now Red isn't publicly traded, so you really only have to go based on what's published online or what Red has said about themselves. But I saw somewhere along the lines that their 2023 revenue was like $150 million or something like that, which would mean if they accepted a buyout at less than their revenue, there's a lot that we're not necessarily seeing that would say, okay, well, that's why the value is less. So there's either a lot of debt, or there's other things we don't know, or Red just really wanted to be acquired.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah, that's entirely, people might just want to step back from running that. I could certainly see that after it's been like 20 years at this point that they've been making this. It's tough to say. I was really expecting more in the neighborhood of like 250 was kind of what I had in my mind when I initially heard this news. This really surprised me.
I actually asked my wife, like, how much do you think that cost? And she doesn't have a ton of like knowledge of how like acquisitions or whatnot. Right. But she was going to guess, like, I don't know, $250,000.
Yeah.
Seems reasonable. And it's like, oh, that does seem low. And here's the other thing. Yeah, I haven't written it yet. Yeah. $250 million. Sorry. I haven't written it yet, but I'm hoping to, but I kind of wanted to contextualize this purchase. That's really difficult to do. The camera industry hasn't really seen a buyout like this before. The one that we wanted to compare it to was Konica Minolta getting purchased by Sony. But Sony, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this and anyone listening, they're excellent at obfuscating any of their individual purchases, or like they don't even tell you how much their camera division specifically makes because they bundle it with other things. So you can't tell how many Alpha series they sold or whatever.
Yeah.
It was similar with Konica Minolta. They didn't outright buy it either. Konica Minolta, right before like Sony purchased the parts that they did, was like not doing well. They were like basically a sinking ship. And so Sony was just picking the parts they liked and absorbed those, but they didn't really publish how much they paid for any of them. A lot of it was like share exchange, and like none of it was like pure cash like this. So it has been very difficult for us to contextualize if this was a good or bad deal or even normal.
Yeah.
So
it's mysterious.
Well,
we'll see. I mean, if Nikon owns 100% of that of the stake, I mean, they can now do whatever they see fit to do with the Red brand, right? Because we were always kind of wondering, like, oh, is it going to be sort of a split? Are they still going to keep Red as a brand and Nikon as a brand and then some sort of crossover? But I mean, Nikon could basically, just like Sony did with Konica, they could feasibly just absorb the entire company into the Nikon brand name.
And stop using the Red one. If they wanted to, they could. Yeah.
Good dude.
I mean, that does explain what they've already done with their leadership structure. They already replaced leadership. Like,
absolutely.
So,
yeah. There you go.
Exciting. All right. Before we talk about the new stuff, one more thing I wanted to mention is that we talked about this, I think, last week or the week before, that Canon wasn't doing great. Like, their profits were down, their revenues were down. Well, if you wanted to think, well, that could possibly just be the whole camera industry is down. Nope. Fujifilm is showing that you can make a buttload of money in this industry if you know what you're selling. So last year I reported that Instax made up more than half of all of Fujifilm's imaging division. That was an understatement. It was like 66% of all of the revenue was that. Well, this year, that actually fell to like 65-ish, 64-ish percent because their pro imaging, which is anything that's not Instax, grew by 20% over the previous year. Just an absolutely massive growth. And they point to three specific cameras, the XS20, the GFX102, and the X106. And what's interesting about that is the X106 will have only been on sale for a month upon the announcement of these of this thing. So
the ride I don't know how wave. Much.
Yeah, like I have to think that a lot was X106 because they literally sold every X106 they had access to immediately.
But let's also remember a lot of the X106 demand was leftover X105 demand that still hadn't been supplied.
Yeah. Everyone just switched their orders.
Yeah, I mean, you can make money when the demand is so high that you can't supply enough for it. You can only go up from there. So, yeah, good for them. Big, big wave. And the XS20, great camera.
XT5s are only now starting to be available as well. Like a lot of anything basically retro designed has been moving like crazy for them. And clearly the GFX102 did as well.
Overall, their imaging division's revenue is up 14.5% over the last year. Their operating income is up 39.9% in this one division year over year. That is insane growth. They are doing so well. All of their cameras are doing well.
And what's like really exciting for photographers is if they're doing extremely well, that means we're going to see the kind of investment
Canon
in R&D
Instax
that
cameras?
We haven't seen. Within Fujifilm, they're going to start really developing. I feel like everybody has kind of slowed down a little bit in that regard as the industry has contracted. This is one of those exciting things where they might be like, let's throw a lot of R&D at our camera division because it's clearly paying dividends. So we might see some really cool cutting edge stuff. And Fujifilm, there are some areas where they still have some room to catch up, like autofocus. So that's really exciting.
Sure. But I mean, they made such good strides with medium format. I mean, that was a huge coup, right? I mean, they've turned into the preeminent medium format camera manufacturer, I would say, for the masses. I'm curious how well Leica does with the Sofort. I bet they do okay. Like, it's a very profitable, I'm assuming it's a fairly high margin area with the film. So, yeah, Leica Sofort.
Leica Instax. I'm pretty sure they're licensing too, so their profit will be down. Because they license, but just to put this in context of money, consumer imaging, which is just Instax, that's all Instax products, made them 297.6 billion yen over the last year. And then their professional imaging did 172.1 billion yen. So when I was sitting in Japan for the X106 launch, and that was a big launch. This room was filled wall to wall with people that they flew there. I was like, man, this looks expensive. Yeah, it probably was. But also, they can afford it. They have so much money.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a big piece of the pie. It's worth doing even if you're paying licensing fees, right? Like, it's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about new stuff. And I'm going to contextualize this a bit. I know nothing. I haven't read anything yet because we are recording this a week in advance. So, and like, I have a basic overview of a lot of these things, but I haven't sat and actually like read everything. So you guys are going to explain to me things that I don't know yet. And hopefully it'll serve as a good way for people to get an idea of what happened this week and what's the important high level notes to remember. So first thing we're going to talk about before we get into our main topic, which is a bunch of Fujifilm things, Sigma has a new 24-70 f/2.8 that I know nothing about. So please, one of you, tell me, why is this one, what's different about this versus the last one they did?
So this is interesting. Well, go ahead, Jared. Yeah, go ahead, Jordan. You go.
Oh, I said go, Chris. So we were fans of the 24-70, but when we were doing our recent video talking about how like you could shoot all pro stuff, Chris did specify like, look, the 24-70 is totally a decent lens. A pro could use it. It's not my favorite 24-70. Yeah. There were still definite advantages looking at the, especially if you're looking at E-mount, the Sony GM2, and then they've brought out this new lens in an attempt to really rectify that. So it is definitely sharper, in a lot of ways comparable to what we're seeing with the GM2, which still has a bit of an edge at the wide angle, but it's also a much more expensive lens. But now the autofocus is indistinguishable. You still obviously won't have access to, you know, shooting faster than 15 frames per second with tracking autofocus on the very fast Sony bodies, but I don't think that's a limitation of this lens motor. It is damn zippy. We were doing some like crash where we're just pushing the camera very quickly forward and back at a model's face at 120 frames per second, and it didn't skip a beat, same as the GM2. Yeah. So that's quite exciting, and improved bokeh as well.
Yeah, the bokeh is much nicer. Yeah.
This is one of the best sample galleries, I think, Chris has shot.
I appreciate that. But we had it. But we had a nice location to do it. We actually took a work trip out to Vancouver Island, and we were thinking that some of the new Fujifilm stuff that we're about to talk about would be available, but it just wasn't available in time. So we're like, what are we going to take? And then the Sigma 24-70 showed up, you know, honestly, like a couple days before. Like, it was pretty wild. So we're like, this is what we're taking. I was happy about that because it's a great general purpose lens for vacation and for travel and stuff. So lighter, smaller. The price is excellent given what you're getting. I mean, that seems to be a hallmark with Sigma right now. I don't know. It's just way less than the Sony.
We still don't know the price.
We still don't know. Okay. It'll be in the link in the description below. I will put the price as well as a link to the full.
But we've been assured by Sigma that it is substantially less than the Sony G Master, which isn't hard to do, frankly. So
how much is the G Master?
It's still over 2,000, I think.
I think 2,300 would be my guess.
And this is substantially less in quotes?
Yeah, substantially less. And the G Master is still an awesome lens. I would still say from an optical standpoint, it cannot be beat, but the Sigma comes close for way less money. So very nice lens.
And it's worth pointing out, we're comparing these two on a 61 megapixel sensor. So the guys that we were talking to out on the island there who are looking to use it primarily for video, they're like, even if we're shooting 8K, the differences here will be unnoticeable.
Negligible.
So they're like, the Sigma is the clear no-brainer for us to grab. Very exciting stuff. And it's nice to see them kind of, the lenses that we were maybe a little more ambivalent about are now getting updated to, again, be something that we're like, this is one of the best in class. For
it's probably going to be a while for the 70-200, though. That just came out.
That just came out. And I was just going to say, you know, talk about that. I mean, it's a good lens. Like, there's no doubt it's a good lens. But I feel like that one still has some compromises, especially compared to the Sony. Whereas I feel this 24-70 is definitely closer to what is the best available. The 70-200 does not feel that same way. So, take from that what you will.
Cool. Well, I will link to the information about it in the description below. And also below the like button is a link to Chris's review. So you can watch that and get his full opinions on it. But that is good information to know. And with that behind us, let's talk about Fujifilm blowing up the week with four announcements. So we're going to go over these.
Damn you, Fujifilm. Damn you, Fujifilm, for releasing four products in the same week with limited time. It has been a struggle.
This week, we only...
But damn you straight to hell.
We only were able to review two of these items in time because this duo is extremely busy.
Yeah.
You can expect the two lenses, those two reviews, to come in the following weeks. They wanted to not rush them and spend time with them, so that's what we're going to do. But let's talk about the X-T50 first.
Yes.
What is the deal and what excites you about it? What should people be excited about? What does this do better or differently than the rest of Fujifilm's lineup? This week's main story sponsor is Bay Photo. Professional quality prints are the perfect way to elevate your photography, and if you have your own photo business, a great way to boost sales. With Bay Photo as your partner lab, you can easily order and quickly deliver stunning photo products to your clients. Bay Photo uses top quality and sustainable materials, and quick turnaround and white label shipping allow customers to deliver directly to clients with assurance. They even offer optional color correction performed by the professional trained technicians to ensure the best results from your images. Bay Photo also offers the most reliable customer service available, which they know is important to you as your partner in photography. Bay Photo's intuitive online ordering platform was custom developed for photographers, including tools to help you sell your prints. One of these features allows you to generate custom wall previews to see and share what your prints will look like before even ordering. Innovation has upheld Bay Photo's success through the transition from film to digital, and today they have the largest selection of products and display options and are known for their customization. Petapixel viewers can save 25% off any one-wall display order with promo code PETAPIXEL25. This includes metal prints, acrylic prints, framed prints, epic prints, canvas wraps, and so much more. Go to bayphoto.com/petapixel to create your own next high-impact display today. Thanks to Bay Photo for sponsoring this main story segment.
So actually, the first thing I'll talk about that struck me, I mean, it still feels much like the other X-T double-digit cameras insofar as it's lightweight, not weather-sealed.
Jordan's holding it.
Very compact, kind of retro-inspired. But they went with this more like contoured Japanese castle wall kind of feel. And I dig it. And the grip is way better. So I think one thing people will really notice is like the camera itself has a totally different handling structure than other X-T, you know, 20, 30 series cameras. And that was a big bonus. Still has the pop-up flash, you know, same kind of feel, incredibly lightweight. But the huge change, other than the fact they put the 40 megapixel sensor, we all expected that. And that's nice. It's a great photographic sensor. The huge change is now the X-T series 20, 30, blah, blah, blah. The 50 now has IBIS. And I think that really expands a lot for this range because it now means that maybe more advanced photographers might want to rely on this camera as a backup camera to an X-T5 or as a great lightweight walk around or travel camera and still get that excellent IBIS. I mean, 7-stop rated, it seemed very stable to me. And the benefit there, of course, is if you are using lenses that don't have image stabilization like the new 16-50, you still get that covered. So that's I think maybe going forward, we're going to see IBIS in all of these cameras now.
I hope so.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. We said a while ago, I don't know what sensor Fujifilm is going to wind up using in the mid-range because they're clearly trying to make inroads in video land right now. And then they've got this great 40 megapixel sensor for stills. And this is priced very similar to the XS20, which gets you the things video people will really like getting that fully articulating screen, the headphone jack on it, much better battery life, and the 26 megapixel sensor that can read out full width oversampled video, where this has to either do some binning or it's got to apply a crop for your other record modes there. And the rolling shutter in those crops is bad.
Rough.
So this is their photographer forward camera. The XS20 will be their more video centric model at similar price point. I think that's a really good solution for this.
But I mean, XS is a good example because XS is like one of the main selling features for the XS was you get IBIS. You know what I mean? And so to see Fuji expanding this into the more entry-level cameras is fantastic. You still don't get great displays though, and that's disappointing.
Yeah, at this price, the 2.36 million dot displays is just a joke. I really feel like this is not a cheap camera. For substantially less, you could get like a full frame Nikon Z5 with a 3.69 million dot big bright viewfinder. So that seems like a real step back in this class of camera.
And it won't shoot as fast as an X-T5, but it will focus as fast. So you could look at this as like a baby X-T5.
Yeah, depending on the type of work you're doing, especially like portrait, landscape stuff. This is a great budget way to get access to, I would say, probably our favorite APS-C sensor for photography.
Sure.
We'll loop back on this after we talk about all the stuff that they announced, because I want you guys to actually go through Fuji's line and talk about what the best one is in each section, because there's a lot now, and I feel like that's worth talking about.
Lots.
But before we get there, let's talk GFX 100 S2 that was also announced this week. Jordan's reaching around for it.
It's still charging. Here we go.
All right.
I haven't played with it yet. I haven't touched it.
All right, so then Jordan, you should talk a little bit about it then.
We're actually shooting today.
Yeah,
today.
The review is being shot today, but we still want to be able to give you a little bit more information about it. So Jordan, take it away.
Yeah, so this is coming very shortly after the GFX 100-2, a lower-end body. The body design is very similar to what we saw with the GFX 100S, which is one of my favorite. Just value for the dollar, image quality for the price is one of the best cameras ever made, I would say. And it's kind of surprising how much, especially for photographers, they've carried over from that 100-2. So we've got that same beautiful 100 megapixel sensor. They've said it's not the fast reading version of that, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't seem to have the ability to drop the bit depth to reduce rolling shutter like what we saw in the 100-2. But that might just be a way of segmenting them. As a result, this can do 7 frames per second down from 8, and it's missing some of the video features that we've
seen.
Has
IBIS.
Has very effective IBIS. We've got identical autofocus.
You're down to SD card slots instead of CF Express. That kind of, you keep going.
same autofocus. The big one for me, the 3.69 million dot display on the GFX 100S was not great for actually checking your image sharpness. We've moved up to the 5.76 here, which is a really nice upgrade. But unlike the 100-2, it's not removable. So you're going to have to be happy with what you get there. But it's a much better viewfinder on that right now.
Are you going to like it for video?
Probably. Like I've said before, all the GFX 100 body, including the older ones, are like, in a pinch, you can use them for video. But this sensor is not great for that. So we're going to see the exact same kind of thing here where it's binning in order to get full width read out on it. And it's missing a lot of the crop modes, especially like anamorphic and things that we saw in the 100-2 as well, because there's no CF Express card slot, as Chris mentioned.
Yeah.
You're not getting the super high data rates, but this will still let you kick those out to an external SSD if you
see, this
want.
Is a great week for me because all of this Fujifilm gear is really more photographically.
Yeah, I was going to mention that it seems to me that as much as they were leaning video earlier, as with like the last GFX, both these cameras are very much photography centric.
Yes.
I was going to ask you guys, even though they do offer video features in there, for whatever reason, someone might want to use them, maybe, as you say, Jordan, in a pinch, would you say this is a smart way to go about doing a camera line, series of camera lines where you're like, yeah, they do have some overlap, but there's very clearly lines between what we would recommend for photo and video, as opposed to making everything a hybrid?
I think it's kind of smart, and I think they're just limited. The sensors are making that decision for
them.
It's
the sensors, yeah.
So I think just offering a lot of these camera models with different sensors is a smart solution for that. You know, I'd love to, if Fujifilm wants to get a very fast 50 megapixel medium format sensor and say, this is the video and sports model. Because, I mean, we'll talk about it. They've got a 500 millimeter medium format lens that they just launched. They're going after wildlife photographers. Yeah. Then that would make things very interesting. But right now, it's pretty much the ancient 50 that I don't think people should be investing in at this point, or the 100 megapixel Sony, which is a great photography sensor, not great for video.
Okay. Well, we've got two cameras down, but we're only halfway done. I should specify, the following two lenses people shouldn't be surprised about. Fujifilm has a lens roadmap. They talk about what they're doing. They actually already mentioned that this 16-50 was coming earlier this year at the X106 event, but now it's here.
Yes.
What do we think?
So the primary reason, I mean, first off, the 1855 built a huge legendary status because it was really released at a time when other kit lenses were very much affordable but pedestrian lenses, you know, and
I would have been
the
meaner.
Companies didn't even try to cover that up. I mean, really, everybody understood it, right? Kit lens was a dirty word. And when Fuji came out with this 18 to 55, first off, 2.8 to 4, even if it's not a huge difference in light from 3.5 to 5.6, like most kit lenses, it is still substantial. And so, and psychologically, it's substantial as well. And so people really bought onto it. It turned out to be very good optically. It was kind of lens that you didn't have to replace a year later because it was still very good. We even did a comparison with the new Sigma 18 to 50 in one of our videos, the 18 to 50 2.8. And we were surprised how well this aged lens did against a modern contemporary peer. And so it absolutely deserved its legendary status. The 16 to 50 had to come out though, because the 18 to 55 can't quite resolve the new 40 megapixel sensors. And that is going to be an issue going forward. So the 16 to 50 widens things, it lightens things. You do lose some light, which is unfortunate. That 4.8 at the telephoto range didn't really, you know, blow me away or put a smile on my face.
No, and it's shorter too. Yeah.
Yeah, a little shorter. I would watch, obviously, our video review because we go into much more depth. But the gist of it is, you know, the optics, the flare resistance, the bokeh, that's all kind of middling performance. I wasn't blown away, but it is a sharp lens throughout both ranges. Very good wide at the wide range. And you absolutely need that to be able to resolve on the 40 megapixel sensor. So I feel like if you're still using the older sensors or you're happy with a camera that has a 26 megapixel sensor, the 1855 would still do well for you. The 16 to 50 is absolutely the essential kit lens if you're going to get a 40 megapixel sensor, like with the X-T50. And obviously this makes a lot of sense for Fujifilm going forward to have a kit lens that will accommodate their entire lineup of APS-C cameras in the future.
Yeah, it took me a second to realize, like, when the first one came out, their max was a 16 megapixel sensor with the XE1 when that launched. So yeah, moving up to 40 is a lot more demanding. The other big one is this is fully weather sealed and it's an internal zoom. So I do really feel like they're looking towards, you know, their more rugged cameras. I think we'll hopefully see that extend lower in the lineup. This is an indication of that potentially. But also, they recognize, you know, they didn't have videographers using Fuji cameras until quite recently. Having that wider starting point means you can apply a little bit more like digital shake reduction to it. You know, use some of the different crop modes like what we're seeing in the X-T5 and not have, you know, a very hugely reduced field of view with those. And for floating on a gimbal, yeah, having that internal zoom means you won't have to rebalance when you reframe. And that's going to be super useful.
Would you say that the only... Chris, you seem to have like this confliction in you. Like, yeah, this does things right. Well, but you're comparing it to what came before. Is that really the only reason there's this confliction? Like most companies, if you were to look at their kit lenses... You're not thinking very highly of
There's
them.
No expectations, yeah.
There's you right. Yeah. But so are you feeling this way about it because of what the previous lens did for you? You were so impressed with it for what it was.
I guess to keep it in context, it's not so, I mean, the lens is optically fine. You know, the Sunstars are gross and you know how much I love Sunstars. but no, I mean, I guess what I'm really trying to put out as an expectation for people is this is going to be a fantastic workhorse lens. I feel like the psychological impact of the 18 to 55 and sort of the status that it got as this unique piece of gear, especially when compared to other contemporary manufacturers, that's not going to be the case here. What's going to be the case here is this is going to be a maybe more, I don't want to say the word boring, but, you know, it's going to be a more workhorse kind of no-nonsense lens that gets the job done for higher resolution sensors. So I think it's absolutely an essential move on Fujifilm's part. I just don't think it's going to have the same cachet that the 1855 had.
Yeah, its competition is a little bit stiffer now. And as well, when that 1855 came out, what third-party mirrorless standard zooms were out there? Now we've got a bunch of great options as well.
Yeah, lots of great options.
So that does make it a little bit less compelling. But again, if you're buying this with a camera, you will get a smoking deal on it.
Yeah.
If you're looking to buy it as a standalone lens, like you already have an 18-55 and you're thinking of upgrading, well, then you're getting very close to like some of the excellent 2.8 options out there.
I should also point out, I think it's important to mention, like we don't have the exact pricing, but you know, to give context, and I know there's inflation and stuff, but the 1855, as I recall, when you got it as a kit with a body, it added maybe like another $300 or something like that. Where, you know, and if you bought it separately, it was like $700. And I feel like on this lens, it looks more like now if you buy it with a kit, it's like $600. And if you buy it separately, it's almost $1,000. So, you know, the price has gone up for sure.
It's still $699.
Oh, so he's wrong? He's right? I don't understand.
So the kit price is a little higher, but the retail list on the lens still on its own is still identical to the old
lens. Kit price higher.
All right. Okay. So the last lens is one that I'm personally the most interested in because it is unusual.
We haven't played with it yet. I can't help you. Sorry.
I guess just tell me the thoughts on a 500 millimeter, which what is that equivalent to?
It is a 400 f4.5, which is a very exciting Nikon lens that just came out. I found that very interesting.
So yeah,
it's actually 396 millimeters, Jordan. Just so you know, 396 millimeter full frame equivalent.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is. Look, I'm sorry I corrected you on the price of the kit. Okay, anyways. So, they've said for a long time, like the GFX series, we really want to start moving into sports and wildlife. That's a niche that, you know, medium format historically hasn't done, but we feel like the technology is there for it. But their lenses, you know, they were all still fairly short. I believe the 1-3 was their longest in their GFX lineup. Mm-hmm. So this really makes a very clear statement that, we're going after the wildlife photography. They have the animal detection now built into the cameras. So this will be a good test for it. That said, it is there is a direct 35 millimeter equivalent that'll get you a similar depth of field and focal range available, at least in Z mount. But even like that Sigma 500 mil is quite close that we can see now for Sony and L mount. But it's a statement lens. It says we are expanding the range where you can use medium format.
I'm sure it'll be great optically. All right. I mean, like I'm sure Fujifilm can make an excellent 500 mil. We'll see, but I'm confident it's going to be very nice optically. I have to admit, so I'll say this with all honesty to the viewers. I've been one of those that's, we're talking about the GFX 100 too, and how it's got, you know, faster focusing and all and faster burst rates. And I'm like, I'd be the first to admit I was skeptical and I'm like, why is medium format playing in this arena? This is not for it, right? And I'm not alone. I know a lot of people.
No, I feel the same way.
But yeah. And now I'm kind of like, well, with this lens, like Fujifilm is crazy like a fox, you know, like every time they do something, it's very easy to be like, this is a silly idea. Like, why would you do this? But then now looking forward, maybe it's, I don't know, like maybe it's not silly. I mean, they were one of the ones to push the GFX 100S as a street camera, right? And stuff like that. So, and everybody's like, why would you use medium format on the street? That's stupid. But now a lot of people are like, I love doing it.
Yeah, now it's pretty standard. And the thing to remember, we always drop like the, you could get the same depth of field and field of view in a full frame equivalent. You're not getting it at 100 megapixels with bags and bags of dynamic range. So there is still a real reason to do this. The big thing to remember is a lot of that fine detail and that dynamic range is going to start to diminish as you start to raise your ISO. So that's why we see like a lot of medium format stuff is very base ISO dependent. Yeah. Where shooting wildlife, you're probably going to be cranking that up quite a bit. It's a 5.6 maximum aperture. That's where you could really see like, I don't know, we're basically at parity here with a full frame system.
You might want to throw
which would have a faster, lens with the same.
Are we experiencing the same caveats at both ends of the sensor size spectrum here? Because it if you just removed what you just said and replaced that with Micro Four Thirds, I would feel exactly the same way. But there are more advantages to Micro Four Thirds in the sense that it's smaller and you can get more range in a smaller package as opposed to what happens, but you get more dynamic range. Maybe, I guess not if you're pushing your ISO at the top of medium format. So it's odd to me. It's like a parabola.
Yeah.
At both ends, you're coming to the same problems.
But medium format is still not going to have very good rolling shutters can be an issue. It's not going to have a very usable electronic shutter for sports and action. You're still not going to get the high burst rates, although that's changing, but that's still a detriment. And don't get me wrong, I still think a modern full frame platform is a way better option for sports action and wildlife. Personally, but I think if Fujifilm's like, hey, let's do something crazy for our owners, for our users, live your truth, Fujifilm, live your truth.
I think everyone's just saying look, not many people invest in multiple camera systems. If you invested in ours, there's not a genre you can't tackle. It might not be the best in class at that particular thing, but if you're a GFX shooter, you can really handle most types of photography right now.
Which is pretty cool. Can't do that with a Hasselblad. Phase one.
No. What I want you guys to think about, and we're going to come back to this discussion in 2 weeks because that's when we are scheduled to have your review done. I want to have a talk about wildlife photography on medium format. After your experience, after your view is done, is it real? Can it be done? And what do we think about what needs to be adjusted to really make it great, or if anything at all? So that's going
to
be a topic
to try it.
Yeah, that'll be a topic in 2 weeks for the podcast. So we'll table that for now. And so now that we know everything that is out, we've given everyone the 411. Now I know everything. I want you guys to talk to me about the best camera choices across Fuji's entire line and who they're for, because we basically had a similar discussion to this with Sony, where they essentially make 1,000 products and it's very difficult to tell which one is for who. I think Fujifilm might do a slightly better job of actually maintaining product lines over time, except for the X-Pro series. So tell me, what's the lowest end Fujifilm and who's it for? And what's the highest end Fujifilm and who's it for? And then everything in between.
We're doing everything?
I think the lowest I would look at really is the X-T32. That's where you're getting into the classic Fujifilm handling that everybody likes. The autofocus on is quite reasonable. Anything below that, and I believe most of them have actually been discontinued at this point. It's just the autofocus is too slow on those, especially anything with the 24 megapixel chip. So I wouldn't even look in that direction. I think you really start with the X-T32. Which has the 26 megapixel chip. If you're more interested in video, then the XS20 step above that is just a huge upgrade for video. And there are some advantages for photography, but for most photography people, they should go to as Chris mentioned, the XT50.
Well, yeah. And that's a unique change now, because I would say the XS20 is a great option. It's actually quite affordable given what it had. It did feature IBIS, which was a big benefit for that platform. And it gave users more of an SLR way of handling, less analog, a little bit more contemporary. And I liked that. I didn't mind that. But now with the XT50, that does change things. I would still say for people looking at the XT50 and make sure we get this out right, it is clearly more aimed at making it accessible to the beginner user. I mean, especially having a command dial, which is dedicated to film simulation modes, right? That's going to be very polarizing. I mean, a lot of beginners are going to love it. Some people who like to play with the simulation modes are going to love it. But then the more advanced photographers are like, I shoot raw and do it all later. That's a useless dial for them, right? So in the one hand, the X-T50 is definitely aimed at introducing beginners, but at the same time, it has enough capabilities that I think advanced photographers other than that command dial will also find merit there. So don't be too jaded on that. But yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense now for a lot of people because it has IBIS, as long as you don't need the rugged weather sealing.
Okay. Well,
yeah, X-100.
X-100 stands in a class by itself and you can't get one anyways.
So, good luck.
So yeah. I decided on a whim here just to go look at what Fujifilm sells in the United States and like what their lines are. How many cameras do you think they have on here that are current? How many do you think that they are advertising as cameras that we sell right now that are like you should get?
Oh my God.
What's your guess, Jordan? No, you don't. You're not allowed to look, Chris. You have to guess.
Oh, off the stop typing and clicking. 13. I'm
off the cuff. You think 13, Chris?
That they still market?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm gonna go 16.
It's 18.
What? Yeah.
Yeah. So here they are. That's too many. In order: X105, X106, XE4, XT200, XT32,
XS2. Still the 200? Oh man.
Yeah. XS10, XS20. XT4, XT5, X-Pro3, XH2, XH2S, and that's all X-Mount. Yeah, then it moves up to GFX, 50R and 50S, 50S2, 50S, 100S, 100 and 102, and on these, there are still two cameras that aren't on this list yet, so really it's 20,
right?
Because there's the XT50 and then the 100S2. So this is almost as bad, if not as bad, as Sony's situation. There's too many options.
Pretty out of control.
And a lot of them are
way too old.
That's hard
to recommend.
The GFX 50S original? Are you kidding me?
It's still on here.
We never liked that camera. Yeah. But I mean, you know, just to continue with our previous conversation then, like, yeah, so obviously, you know, the ones we don't recommend. The 102 is going to be your best choice if you want, you know, battery life, you want video capabilities. It'll be the best capable video, I suppose, right now out of GFX. I am excited about, we've always loved the S's, right, Jordan?
Yeah, I think it's a perfect compromise because these cameras aren't built for speed, and that's really what you're giving up compared to the 102, as well as that lovely 9.76 million dot viewfinder, but the 5.76 is still fantastic. So
yes,
I think it's going to be a sweet spot for a lot of people. And I remember when the original GFX 100 came out, and then shortly after they launched the 100S, a lot of people felt burned. Like, why do I have this giant camera with the worst vertical grip ever made on a camera when this lower cost option, which handles wonderfully and gives me the same image quality, is now available for thousands and thousands of dollars less? They've just done the same thing again.
But the 100 version 2 is an excellent camera. I like it way better than the original 100.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
I like the new body design. It's nice to have the removable EVF. Some people might appreciate that. Absolutely, it's a great camera. Yeah. But I really do strongly feel I'm going to like this new 100S 2 much better.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you guys an out here because I don't think you can effectively answer this question now.
Uh-oh.
So we're going to table this, and I'm aiming it for the end of June. We're going to go through and do what we did to Sony to Fujifilm and see what on here do we need to start, like, you know, kick that off. We don't need it on here anymore. Here's the meat of the actual camera lineup, because this is starting to get, and by starting, I mean, it is well beyond cumbersome.
Yeah.
They could get down to 12 cameras, I think, easily.
I think we could do it. So we'll do that next time. Stay tuned for that episode. For now,
be ready to hate our guts, Fujifilm users.
For now, we're gonna be done. That's the main topic. We're gonna move on to the regular stuff that we do on this episode. The next is, what have you been up to? And I really just think it's worth saying to everyone, pay attention to the next few weeks. Stuff's ramping up. We can't talk about a lot of it, but just know that there's things to get excited about. It is wild out there.
I do want to say, you know, what we've been up to, really, Jordan and I, we just came back from Vancouver Island. I had a lovely trip. but that video, Jordan assures me, is fantastically good. So yeah,
that's the Sigma 24-70. We didn't mention that. It's longer than you'd usually see with a lens review, but I think it's worth it. So even if that lens isn't in your mount, if you want to watch a super fun video with some gorgeous visuals, you should check it out. Yeah.
And big help from our friends there, you know, from Raymond and Sean, who helped us with the shooting, which obviously makes it more dynamic to have more people. So that worked out really well.
Yeah.
Otherwise, that's it. Yeah, we're in Japan right now. Lord knows what Lumix camera it is. I mean, you'll know by now once this episode comes out.
No,
we have no idea. Is
nope.
it a vlogging camera?
They
is it
still
a
won't know.
Fixed lens camera?
They still won't know.
Still don't know.
We don't know, which is amazing. We legitimately,
we
as of
know.
Recording. But yes, but like in the future when our words are hitting your ear holes, we know.
We will know.
We will know, but they won't know.
But you also won't know. Yeah.
There's a Maybe lot. They don't know.
That is extremely confusing. The other thing I want to mention is I want to take this moment. I'll put this on social too. But like, we apologize for this podcast is late this week. But that is by design because this week is hell. And we wanted to leave some breathing room for the things that the team has done before we put another video up on the channel. So this is being published on a Friday as opposed to a Wednesday. And we apologize for all the folks who like to listen to us on a schedule. I know I've heard some folks who like to listen to us at work on Wednesdays or on the way to work. Sorry, but hopefully
it's Fujifilm's fault. Damn you to hell, Fujifilm. We will see you in hell. We're in hell right now, and we will see you there, Fujifilm.
I mean, if you're bored for content, we did just drop like 50 minutes of YouTube episodes this week.
Treat those as a podcast.
What else we're going to look? No, but I got a new shirt from Orvis. Look,
it's pretty.
It's got a dog. Can you see the dog?
Yes, we can see the dog.
It's got a dog.
It's nice.
And my friend Tom Rosenbauer sent me a hat too. You may have noticed that sometimes I'm wearing Orvis gear. Often I'm wearing Orvis gear on the show. Because Tom helps me out with clothing, and I really appreciate it. And it's nice stuff. Look at that wax canvas.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Jordan's wearing a nice teal shirt, and I'm wearing a in a nutshell Kurzgesagt. How do you say this YouTube channel? You guys know what the
and Jordan on the last podcast wore a nighty. Was that like a muumuu?
It's a nice jammies? It's just a summery T-shirt. I don't know. I was not expecting the vitriol I received in the comments.
I didn't actually see any of those.
Jordan is not a nightgown guy. He's a robe guy. We know that. He's not a nightgown guy.
Do you guys not know this YouTube channel? I've never been able to say it right. It's in German, but it's like Kurzgesagt or something like that. But it means in a nutshell. It's a science channel that teaches you about the world. It's really, I think it's great for kids because it's animated.
I gave up on science after Vsauce went away. So I don't,
All right.
Well, I mean, it's still
I'm sure there's someone listening to this podcast who knows about In a Nutshell and will recognize the artwork.
My kid probably watches it.
It's fantastic. All right.
What are you moving on to Jordan?
Oh,
come on, Jordan.
Jordan, you want to say? I've been editing a bunch of videos.
Yeah,
that's you've been listening to Scary Interesting. I really appreciate you taking one of my recommendations.
Yeah, it's a good podcast. As long as you don't listen to ones about caving, which really bother me, then it's a fun podcast and a good recommendation, Chris.
Yes.
Can we move on now, Chris?
Yes.
Do I have your permission?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to go to tech support. And before we get into this, I do want to make a note. We're going to have to call down how much we answer when it comes to just the questions about what should I buy? Like someone will send we're getting a lot of questions that are essentially like trying to take a moment to just ask Chris and Jordan to make a buying decision for them. They hope, and I'm going to speak for them, that by watching the videos they've produced, they give you all the information you need to make that decision for yourself.
Yeah.
So we want to try and keep tech support broad enough to answer questions a wider range of folks may be interested in, as opposed to just one person who wants to know if they should buy this lens or that lens.
That goes for Instagram DMs as well. Oh, dude, I get so many where it's like, hello, sir, what full frame camera should I buy? I'm not going to answer those. I just won't. I don't have the time. But I do appreciate and will answer as many as I can when you give me context for what you're doing, what you like to do, you know, what your thought process is, and then what camera do you think would fit? Absolutely. But what is the best lens for, you know, Sony that I should get right now? I can't help you out.
Yeah.
Not with that.
No. Well, it's not that we don't want to help you. It's just, it's too much.
We can't.
And it can't do it. So if we don't answer your questions, that's why. They were just too specific. So for example, this first one here from Howron, the first part of your question actually was too broad even to actually answer effectively. You didn't provide enough information for what Chris would have wanted to do anyway. But the second half of your question was actually super interesting and has wider interest for other people. So let's listen to that edited part right now.
Hi, Chris, Jordan, and Jaron. Howron here. I also have a question about teleconverters. Since full frame does better with higher ISOs than APS-C, in theory, how close would a full frame with a 1.4 times teleconverter be to an APS-C camera at the same shutter speed and f-stop?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. So just again, for people that might not know, using the 1.4 teleconverter on a full frame camera is going to give you a similar crop factor to an APS-C with the same or similar lens, but you are going to lose a stop of light. And that should basically, I mean, again, we're talking really rough equivalency here, will basically cost you the advantage in dynamic range and low light performance that you would get out of that full frame camera. So assuming that the megapixel count after the crop would be similar to the APS-C camera, yeah, you could say it's, you know, again, this is all like it's theoretical. It's masturbation. It's technical masturbation on the cameras. But yeah, it'd be pretty similar, don't you think, Jordan?
Yeah, they would be quite close if you're doing that. So especially if you do have to raise the ISO, which is going to be the case with a lot of wildlife shooting, then absolutely. If you can keep it at base, you'll keep your dynamic range advantage.
Sure.
Coming from that. And you will get a slightly different aesthetic to it, you know, actually using a longer focal length as opposed to a crop. But honestly, the results are so negligible. And yeah, you're comparing like a 1.4 times to a 1.5 or 1.6. You actually get more reach with the APS-C crop. So I think it's useful that way.
Very slightly. Also, I guess we should mention, you know, anytime that things are going through a teleconverter, there is going to be some loss of quality because of the extra glass that the light has to go through. But that being said, modern teleconverters are way better than what we were used to even 10 years ago. And so it's fairly negligible. But I think one of the real takeaways whenever anybody's contemplating these relationships between sensor sizes and lenses and stuff is when it comes to light and photons, you really can't get something for nothing. Like there's no free lunch with the light. There's always a compromise. There's always a trade-off. So yeah.
Did you just use an economics term? There's no such thing as a free lunch. Yeah.
Free lunch. That's
a, yeah, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's always a cost.
Not when it comes to light. Not when it comes to light.
And economics. Okay. Next one is a question from Josh on SpeakPipe. They are curious what a good lens for a starting videographer on Sony E-mount might be. And Jordan, they toss in three suggestions. Let's see if you agree with any of them or if you have one you'd rather them select. Now, this one, again, pretty broad. A lot of people might be curious about this. So let's hear it.
Hi, my name is Josh. I am recently looking into buying a lens more geared toward videography, and I wanted your personal opinion. I have three choices that I'm looking at: the Sony 16-35 power zoom with f4, the Tamron 17-28 f2.8, and the new Sony 16-25 2.8. If you could give me your personal opinion on what might be a good starting lens toward videography, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. He started with all ultra wide lenses.
I thought you would think that was interesting too. Yes, yeah. These are all the wider end.
Kind of funky. Although, we don't know if it's a full frame.
Is this full frame or APS-C?
Yeah, I'm going to assume it's full frame. I'm going to assume it's full frame.
So these are all full frame compatible lenses.
That's why. Yeah, that's why.
And yes, we did. My favorite option among those is that new Sony 16-25 weird focal length, but it's also by far the most restrictive in terms of the focal lengths offered. So if this is going to be your first lens, I think you might really butt up against that. My suggestion is actually not out of those three.
It's a
lens that we didn't love for photography, but for video, it makes a ton of sense. And that's the Tamron 17-50. So you're still getting ultra wide, but now moving into a normal field of view, which is going to get you a lot more flexibility. And I think that's the big thing that you're going to miss here. If you said, I already have a standard zoom and I'm looking at an ultra wide complement, then I'd probably lean towards that Sony 16-25. But if it's your first lens, I think it's Tamron first makes lens. A lot of sense. Yeah.
It's the very, very first. So yeah. Cool. All right.
Nice.
Next one is, we've gotten a message from Max from Ukraine before, I believe, but he's got two more here, and both of these are interesting. So let's listen into the first half of his question. Here we go.
Hey guys, Max from Ukraine here. I was wondering, what is your favorite camera menu system? I think for me, it's definitely Panasonic. I think they have the most clearly laid out menu. But what is your favorite?
I mean, mine is, I'm also Team Panasonic. I think that's the best laid out menus by quite a long shot. I also like the Blackmagic main page, but once you get deeper down, it gets kind of messed up. I'm going to say Panasonic is my favorite.
Yeah.
Chris.
It's so, it is so subjective. I think Nikon actually have a really good menu system, and I've always found the Canon interface to be quite easy to use. Yep. You know, the way they lay it out, I like a menu where you have, you don't have to scroll. That's a big one. If I don't have to scroll, ideally I'm happy. I could also say Leica, but Leica's menus are so nice, not only because they're beautiful, but because they're very simplistic. They just don't have a lot of options, so that's not fair. So when it comes to a company managing a lot of options, I do like Nikon and Canon. I think they do a good job. And Panasonic is nice too. Absolutely. Easy to see, clear.
Considering how much they cram into those, the fact that you can navigate it without getting lost is very impressive.
Yeah. Yes. I do think a lot of it too comes down to the fact that Canon and Nikon just haven't changed their menus really at all in the last 20 years. And we review cameras. We're quite familiar with them. There are definitely times with both Canon and Nikon where I'm like, why the hell is this feature buried way down here in the menu?
Yeah.
And it's because they introduced it later. Yeah.
Yeah. Why is format three up from the bottom on page three of system settings? That doesn't make any sense. I need format way more often than I need the other things.
Right. But, you know, I would also say that same argument, like, you know, I've used Panasonic a fair bit, but Jordan, you use it all the time, right? And I know that's part of it. Like, I don't always find it easy to locate things in a Panasonic menu, but I do like the way it's laid out, right?
Yeah. So
that's why this is subjective.
I will say that my favorite, as much as I like Canon menus and as much as I like Canon, by the way, everyone who says that we should be sponsored by everyone else except Canon because we hate on Canon so much, I have to remind you every single time, I'm a Canon shooter. I'm shooting this on Canon right now.
I just said I love Canon menus.
I like Canon. The fact that I'm hard on them is because I love them and I want them to be better. Anyway, I love Canon menus, but it's not my favorite menu. Hasselblad's is. I think Hasselblad's menu is the best. It is the most beautiful. It is easy to navigate. I like the swiping. I like the buttons. I think it's pretty. Mm. Jordan, you look
They do actually a very good job with touchscreen interface. I will give them that. Like,
it's a very good
touchscreen. It's very well done. It's very well done.
Yeah, my only issue there is there's some important features that are really quite buried in the Hasselblad, like the ability to flip the exposure preview on and off, because these are lenses or bodies that will be used with strobes all the time. Why isn't that like right on your quick menu? There have been a few times where I've been like, where is that option I desperately need for the type of photography this camera is built for? But the actual act of going through it, how everything is laid out, I totally agree. I think it's really well done. They just need to maybe shift the order that things are in the subcategories.
It is just so touchscreen dependent too, to really.
It feels very nice to use. Always, it just, if it's very
responsive.
You can't
always rely on touchscreen.
No,
it is
true.
Funny to me though, Hasselblad of all the companies has probably done the best job of making a menu that would appeal or be very familiar to smartphone users. And it's funny that nobody else does that. Mm-hmm. You know, I like being able to like look at a feature and just touch it and look, I can change it. Like that's pretty great. Canon, again, part of why I love their interface and their menus, their touchscreen implementation is also excellent. Yeah. So
they've been doing touch longer than a lot of others though too.
Yeah.
What, Jordan?
When I was reviewing the X2D, I did get wet fingers and the touchscreen stopped operating, which meant I could no longer do anything. So that would be my other comment on the X2D. Yeah, I did dry my finger, Jaren, but it's nice to have something that can be completely controlled through like an autofocus joystick and buttons as well, or with your eye up to the EVF as well. I like to change my menu settings.
That would be fine too. So for what it's
great
worth,
question,
then,
Max.
If that's all you cared about, then I think Canon's is answering all the questions that you want. You can do everything you just said on a Canon.
Yeah, so, fine. Canon wins. Yeah. All right.
But Panasonic is great too.
Panasonic.
The second half of this question, let's listen to that.
And another question is, what is your favorite obscure camera feature? You know, a feature that not a lot of people know about. For me, I think it would be Nikon DSLR's white balance settings, because if you went into the main menu and selected tungsten or fluorescent, they actually had a submenu that wasn't accessible from their quick menu, where you could select from basically 10 types of different tungsten or fluorescent lights to exactly match the ambient lighting that you were taking your photographs in. Anyway, thanks for your answers in advance and love your podcast.
That was quite unique for Nikon. And I would say, like, I agree with Max, but at the same time, there was a lot in there. I feel like not many people wanted to use it because it was so detail rich. But one of the features I would mention from Nikon, actually, it's camera specific, but just having a button that you can press to go to black and white on the Nikon ZF, I love that. I personally wish more cameras had that. You know, X-T50 with the command dial is kind of close because I could go from color to black and white with one click of the dial. Yeah. But I really do like having that button, and I think that's awesome. Yeah. One quick touch. Boom. Black and white. Back to color. I like that a lot. The other one I would say, I don't know if I'm stealing this from you, Jordan, but Panasonic, there was actually a really neat obscure feature where you could set your focus limit.
That was going to be my
where
video
the camera
pick.
Would actually work within. That was a really cool feature. And it took a little bit of setup, but it was actually insanely useful.
Oh, so that's actually a little different from what I was talking about. Yes, I do really like the focus limiter. And that's what I was going to say for photography. We once did a video like, hey, all cameras should have focus limiters, just like what's on your telephoto saying, hey, only focus between this range and this range. And we've actually seen Panasonic, Olympus, and Fujifilm put those in their camera menus now. And I find it insanely useful, even if you're not using a telephoto, you know, shooting kids sports or something, you can set up your own custom range that it'll only work.
And how many people
really
use that? Might still be obscure.
It's very buried in all of those cameras. I don't think anyone uses that feature. The other one I thought you were talking about at first is Panasonic's focus transition feature, which I use for breathing tests and product shots. Constantly, you can set in up to three focus points, say point one, two, three, the speed that it'll transition between them, and you'll get perfect focus pulls every time. Is something I would love to see in every other camera system. It's a big part of why I shoot all my B-roll just with Lumix bodies. This is a trick that's a real lifesaver. And again, really buried in the menus. Most people don't know about it.
I don't have one. Because I will admit, I'm not the most technically savvy on bodies. Like, as long as I can get the autofocus to work right and the buttons do what I tell them to, I'm happy. So I don't dig around in there because it frightens me. And Sony really scarred me. The original Sony menus really, really hurt me in a way that I can't put any other way. And I don't
it
ever
gets
like
better,
going.
Jared. It gets better.
The recovery is a slow path, and I will work my way there.
I've been in an Airbnb with Jaron and the night terrors where he's just like, is it tab 6 or tab 7? I'm sorry, everyone. Back to sleep.
Why
sleep
is memory
paralysis
card format in the camera menu?
My sleep paralysis demon is actually just an old Sony NX or like the original like Sony one just sitting on my chest looking at me. Anyway. The last speak pipe of the week is from Serafino, which is a wonderful name. Love the name. Let's listen in.
Hi, Chris, Jaron, and Jordan. My name is Serafino, and I'm from Singapore, which is in Southeast Asia. I've been working as a photographer and videographer for about 2 years now. And in my time, I've experienced that the photo and video industry is quite toxic. I feel like I'm getting yelled at and cursed at, and people are really impatient the vast majority of the time, like as in other photographers and videographers who I'm working with or working for. I'm curious to know, is this your experience as well, or is it just my country that's like this?
So Serafino, first off, thank you for specifying where Singapore is, but as Canadians, we are actually taught about other people's geography because we're like that. Unlike America, where it's
stop
you just
it.
You barely even
I actually couldn't
country.
Point to Singapore on the map, but I know that it's in Southeast Asia.
But yeah, I don't know if you're getting yelled at and cursed at. That sounds horrible. I don't think that really happens in our industry in North America as much. People tend to be fairly good with collaboration. There's certainly a lot of insecurity and jealousy in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely been only hurt further by social media and, you know, hustle culture and having to compare yourself to everybody else. Are they doing more than I am? Am I doing more than them? And that can make you quite internally angry. But I don't think we tend to explode too much.
I have a thought on this, which is basically the further you progress in your career, the more likable everyone is going to be, because a lot of people get stuck at the bottom because they're petty or argumentative, difficult to work with clients. As you get better and better, you're going to start like we certainly find this in the Calgary production scene. It's just like the people at kind of the top of the game are also
really good, agreeable people who are excellent collaborators. And I think you'll find something similar as you continue working with, you know, higher end clients and collaborating with higher end other photographers. You're going to find that they start to get lovelier and lovelier as you progress there. But certainly there does tend to be a big sea of people who aren't very far along, or they've been doing this for a long time and they're not getting anywhere because they suck as humans. And that's something that you're going to bump up against.
I'll answer this in two parts. Firstly, I do think that generally speaking, there is quite a bit of toxicity in photography when it comes to general conversation among hobbyists. Like Petapixel's comment section and even DP Reviews forums, you famously can see that. You can see a lot of that toxicity. And I think it does tie to what Jordan's saying. It's just like people who wish that they could do more and are therefore not being as supportive as they should be of other people's success. The other part I wanted to mention is that I've worked in professional kitchens, like as in like cooking and whatnot. And it is similar. Yeah. Yes, chef. It is very similar where, I mean, it is hyper, it's not as much as it is on TV or in media where they show like everyone's always a jerk, but there is something to be said about how it is in kitchens too. Like at the lower end, you will run into people who are miserly. And as you work with more talented folks and you get into restaurants that know what they're doing more, you run into better and nicer people who actually are like, yeah, this is how you succeed. This is how you get better, because they're able to grow beyond what Jordan was saying. So I think that anywhere where you could probably see art or trying to do something that relies on other people liking it, you are going to run into this issue because some people just don't know how to approach that well.
I would say like the YouTuber, like it's different, you know, the YouTuber community, I would say for photographically and videographically is like quite welcoming, you know, quite supportive. There's so many personalities, you don't always gel with everybody, but I would say the vast majority of people are where you might expect them to be petty because there's always, you know, views and subscription numbers and all this kind of stuff, right? They actually tend to be quite supportive, quite, you know, willing to help out and share information and stuff. In the actual professional photography, videography world, it might be a bit different. But even then, I would say the only feeling I've ever gotten from a lot of like local working photographers in a negative sense has usually just been sort of a very protective, insecure kind of attitude. It's not that they're rude or anything, but they're like very protective of like, oh, I don't want to share my secrets, or I don't want to share my talent, or I don't want to, you know, or, you know, just this competitive feeling where they don't want to be open. So they're quite shut off and cold, but that's the worst I've personally ever experienced from it.
I just really hope narratively that, in the time between when we record this and our trip in Japan, a straight up fist fight breaks out between YouTubers at the press event. And, then we can just report back a week after.
We're wrong about everything.
Man, that was crazy. Those people went animalistic on each other.
My guess, if I was going to guess, it's going to be Jordan throwing fists first. He's going to be the one.
I got the reach.
I will say that sometimes the creative community can be very clicky, which is very high school-y. And I don't like high school. I never liked high school. I was the nerd, so I never liked anything that reminds me of high school. But that doesn't mean it's bad. It's just, you know, clicks form.
Yeah.
Hopefully that answered your question, Serafino. We're sorry you're dealing with toxicity. That's never fun. But
yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah, it sucks. All right, we're going to move on to Never Read the Comments, the section where we always read the comments. And based on last week's podcast, I wanted to mention that there's several folks who are talking about the Tandem OLED on the iPad. And there's a lot of words being tossed around by a lot of people. But when Apple doesn't give a lot of information, that's bound to happen. What I will say is I'm talking to a screen expert that I have worked with for years. And he is going to do a deep dive on how that display is different than other displays that we're more familiar with. And when he does that, I'm going to share it so that we can all look at that and know that there is an answer, as opposed to sitting here and arguing about something we don't know anything about. From there, let's talk about other stuff. Triple KO Shorts says to Jordan, the 1-inch type sensor underwater camera that you were asking for already exists. It's the RX0. Both versions do a good job underwater and have a large sensor and a tiny body. Give it a go.
Yeah, that is actually a nice option. That 24 millimeter wide is certainly preferable to the ultra wide on the GoPros and Insta360s we talked about, but it's still a little bit limiting. But yeah, I forgot that camera was still in production, and it'd be a good choice.
They're nice. Yeah, they're hard to point properly, but yeah, they're good. I've used it a little bit for underwater stuff with trout fitters, and yeah, it does nice video. Not bad.
Kayvon 420, nice, adds, Leica made a fully ruggedized underwater camera a while back called the Leica XU. It was basically an underwater version of the X Type 113, which had a 16 megapixel APS-C sensor and a 23 millimeter f1.7 lens.
In APS-C, which makes it a 35 millimeter equivalent, which is a banging focal length.
That's why
exactly what I want.
Yuck.
They're saying like this would have been great. It would have been nice if like I made a modern version. Imagine the Q3 with the XU's style of housing and features. That would be incredible. And you could really sacrifice an articulating screen for no. Yeah. So you're saying essentially it doesn't exist, but you want it to. I've never heard of this camera.
I think that's exactly what you want to see.
I guess we could say more. It's like, okay, these cameras do exist, but they're long in the tooth, right? Like it's a market that's kind of been abandoned to some degree.
I looked at both of these at the camera store. That's a problem.
Yeah.
This is a neat looking camera. It looks like a submarine.
The XU is
the saving grace of that 23 millimeter lens is it's not a 35 mil equivalent underwater. So huzzah.
Yeah, this camera is no longer available. That's a shame.
No.
All right. Last one is from Blazing Fire Rain. Rain like a rain, yes. rain of
Blaze, fire,
kings,
rain.
Not like rain coming from the sky, like a rain, like, yeah, anyway.
Oh, I just want to point out quickly as well, anytime somebody has 420 in their name, it's actually not a 420 reference. It's referring to 420 color space.
Oh, that's okay. That's much better.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify that after the last comment. Sorry. Go ahead, Jaren.
Cool. Blazing Fire Rain says, I'd be very interested to know what the comments about weather sealing on Hasselblad lenses are coming from. I've heard it elsewhere, in addition to you, from you, Chris, and I believe that it was also mentioned in the 90V video review, so presumably it's not just a wild assumption. But Hasselblad makes no such claims themselves, and indeed, the FAQs on Hasselblad's site for the 25V explicitly state that it has some protection, but it is not IP rated. Well, yeah, almost no lens is, and not recommended for use in wet conditions. As far as I know, the sole Hasselblad lens that they claim is properly sealed is the 28P and has an IP52 rating. I'm generally curious where the claims are coming from, as I've intended to buy an X2D and not possibly a 25V. Yeah. Before you respond, Chris, when someone says it's weather sealed, at no point in a lens, or unless it's explicitly stated otherwise, are we saying that it's proof of any kind? Yeah. Sealing just refers to adding gaskets and making sure that the sections are closed.
They try.
Am I right?
Yeah.
Sony does the same thing.
And, you know, we got a lot of comments about this. And you know, part of it is my bad in oversimplifying it. And that is kind of, we've talked about this before on the podcast, where the term weather sealing is by its nature oversimplified amongst all the manufacturers. There's no standard other than when you get into specific IP ratings, but the vast majority, there's no standards. You know, for a company to say that a lens is weather sealed, it could be as simple as, like you said, Jaren, a rubber gasket on the lens mount and maybe like a dust brush in between the zoom ranges. So, you know, the zoom rings. So it's like, yes, could I be more specific? Absolutely. I'm sorry, but they are still to some degree weather sealed. And that's unfortunately kind of a symptom of the industry where I already have to go into longitudinal chromatic aberration and explain all that. Would I also have to go into like, okay, the lens is weather sealed, but I would say maybe against dust, but maybe not against like this micron of dust and to some degree water.
Well, we can't test it. We have no way of knowing.
Yeah, we can't test it. So
on that note, I think I've mentioned this before. Dave Etchells, formerly of Imaging Resource, tried to build a system that would actually be able to test all lenses and put them on an actual scale. And it was wildly expensive and difficult to use and took up a garage-sized portion of his house. And it's just like, that's why no one is testing is there's no organization that is coming together to say, we're going to do this except IP, which already exists. And almost no camera company uses the IP system for anything because that's very expensive to do for something like a lens or a camera.
Or they specifically do it like OM system, for example, because they want to show, yes, our lenses, you can do this to them. So
Yeah. And I think this also falls on us to push a lot harder to say like, look, you can say as much as you want, put in IP rating on stuff. And I think that's something
none of these will qualify
start doing going forward. Yeah. I don't think either of those Hasselblad lenses would, qualifying.
No hassle,
but there is still some dust resistance compared to, you know, like the first series of Hasselblad HC lenses, which didn't even have a an O-ring on the lens mount.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying like even if it's just an IPX rating for dust or smudging or whatever, they should rate them with something as opposed to just saying weather seal. The problem with that is it would make them not look as good.
Yeah.
Why would they do that?
Yeah. You could just say weather sealed. Just put weather sealed. Asterisk weather sealed.
Yeah.
Good luck with what that means.
It's essentially is the same thing as seeing on a box in America made with natural ingredients. It's not a regulated term, so they can say it.
Right.
All right. There we go.
All right.
Gentlemen, have fun in the land of the rising sun. I wish I was there with you. I will see you when you return. We have a lot more to come in the next several weeks. The calendar is full. We're very excited about it.
But we're in Japan right now. We're in Japan right now.
As these words are hitting ears. Time travel. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
We're there right now.
Through the magic of television.
Depending on when the video is posted.
All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to OM System for sponsoring the episode. As usual, we always love it. Thanks for coming. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
My hair.